how did a group of men with little or no military experience, no knowledge of the Arab world, or personal experience in Iraq come to make such flagrantly debilitating decisions after the U.S. invasion of Iraq? The first film of its kind to chronicle the reasons behind Iraq's descent into guerrilla war, warlord rule, criminality, sectarian violence, and anarchy, No End in Sight, is an insider's tale of wholesale incompetence, recklessness, greed, venality, cronyism. It's based on over 200 hours of footage, and the film provides a candid retelling of the events following the fall of Baghdad in 2003. The interviews contained in No End in Sight include high-ranking officials such as former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, Ambassador Barbara Bodine, who was in charge of Baghdad during the spring of 2003, Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff to Colin Powell, and General Jay Garner, who was actually in charge of the occupation till replaced by Paul Bremer, as well as Iraqi civilians, American soldiers, prominent analysts. Really, the reports, many of them, the interviews and the reports, are from establishment figures. No End in Sight examines the manner in which the principal errors of U.S. policy, the use of insufficient troop levels, allowing the looting of Baghdad, purging of professionals from the Iraqi government, and the disbanding of the Iraqi military largely created the insurgency and chaos that engulf Iraq today. My guest will be Charles Ferguson. Charles Ferguson has created this film, No End in Sight, and he has a very interesting background, which is that he was studied politics in his early life, and then he spent time in the high-tech industry. When he left the high-tech industry, he set out to get back involved in important political issues and set out to produce this film. He's also the author of three books and many articles dealing with various aspects of information technology and its relationships to economic, political, and social issues. Welcome, Charles Ferguson.
Thank you for having me, sir.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people as well as the ideas and the work. And we're going to talk plenty about the film and about the reality that it describes. But I also find your personal story particularly interesting. You've taken some twists and turns, and could you share some of your path to the work that we're going to talk about today?
My past isn't quite as odd as it might seem. In the first place, my PhD thesis advisor was Deputy National Security Advisor for President Kennedy, and so in the course of studying political science and being a policy analyst for a while, I spent a fair amount of time looking at foreign and military policy issues related to the Iraq War and things like it. My detour into high technology came when I started studying the globalization of the information technology sector, and that brought me into contact with a lot of high technology people and companies. And one day in 1993, I had an idea, and it turned out to be an okay idea. And so I started a software company.
And that company was Vermeer, which later was bought by Microsoft. And out of it, they took FrontPage, which was basically the web production software in Microsoft Office.
That's correct.
And that led that into the high-tech industry. Good idea. Good sale led you to be free to act on your earlier passions?
That's exactly right. I've loved film since I was a kid and have always had this kind of secret desire to make films. And that collided with the Iraq War and the fact that as of mid-2005, nobody had made a serious film about American policy in Iraq. And I thought, you know, this is a requirement and an opportunity.
So what did you set out to do, and how did it change along the way?
Well, in a very general sense, it didn't change. I set out to tell the story of what actually happened. And I hope that I've, in fact, done that. What did change, though, was my perception of what, in fact, had happened. When I started making the film, I already knew from conversations with journalists and policy analysts that a number of serious mistakes had been made in the course of the occupation. But I must confess that I really had no idea how jaw-droppingly, stunningly crazy was much of administration policy and many of the things that took place, some of them not having anything to do with politics or ideology, just being matters of normal common sense.
Mm-hmm. And did you expect when you set out to tap into as many not only establishment, not only credible, but also people who were so involved right in the middle of this as it was happening, that you would have access to them?
When I started out, I feared that I would not. The Bush administration early on in the war and the occupation had been remarkably successful at controlling information flows and preventing people from speaking with the senior people involved in the occupation. But as time went on and as the problems with the occupation grew and as many people became frustrated and angry and dispirited, more and more people left and more people began to speak out. And by the time I finished the film, in fact, I was being avalanched with information and with people willing to tell their stories, many of which are really horrifying.
Let's hear a little bit of the audio from the film No End in Sight.
We will bring to the Iraqi people food and medicines and supplies and freedom.
When we were first starting the reconstruction, there were 500 ways to do it wrong and two or three ways to do it right. What we didn't understand is that we were going to go through all 500.
I was chairman of the National Intelligence Council.
I was the director of strategic policy.
Rumsfeld called me and handled humanitarian affairs, reconstruction.
I had been to Iraq 8 times. I knew what the facts on the ground were.
I had no personnel. We had no phones for a while.
I don't think we can do this.
The president had already made a different decision.
There are volumes on how we should do this. And almost none of this was integrated into the Pentagon's thinking.
We watched our careful planning essentially discarded.
There wasn't enough time, but maybe for the next war.
The Americans were not acting as the police. They didn't know the streets of Baghdad. They didn't speak the language. It was a free-for-all.
There was absolute lawlessness.
We're in a transition period.
Stuff happens.
The Iraqi army was essentially standing there waiting.
The Iraqi army has been disbanded, and I was floored.
You had huge ammunition dumps that weren't guarded.
I'm standing there watching these insurgents pull out rockets and mortars and bombs, and the U.S. said to you, we just don't have enough people to cover it.
We never had a single armored Humvee while we were in Iraq.
Why don't we have those resources?
You go to war with the army you have.
We don't have enough troops.
They'll be back there for their 5th, 6th, and 7th tours of duty.
Last contract I ever signed with the government.
We produced a First National estimate on the state of the insurgency. The president called it guesswork. The president hadn't read it.
Life could be lousy. Life could be okay. Life could be better.
If democracy cannot provide for the Iraqi people, people will say, to hell with democracy, we need strong men.
There are nights when I don't sleep very well.
I just can't hold my peace any longer.
And that was some clips, actually the trailer, from the film No End in Sight, The American Occupation of Iraq, which opens in Los Angeles theaters this coming Friday, the 3rd of August. My guest is writer, director, producer Charles Ferguson. You said when we were speaking before that clip that you were amazed in the making of the film as you learned how colossally incompetent things had been done. You make the point that there were three or four major errors. Could you tell us what they are? And then what I'm going to ask you to do, and I'll cut in now and then, is take us through them.
Oh, boy. Well, I would say that there were about a half dozen utterly critical errors. The first two were made before the war, not using enough troops and not beginning the planning for the occupation until less than 2 months before the war started. Then Then there was allowing the looting of much of Iraq, but especially of Baghdad, which had a devastating effect on the physical infrastructure of the country and also on Iraqis' perceptions of the role that the Americans would play in Iraq. And then about a month later, L. Paul Bremer made three critical decisions before he had even arrived in Iraq for the first time. He instituted a long-term occupation and stopped the formation of an interim Iraqi government. He purged the Iraqi government of about 50,000 of its most senior administrators and technocrats, and probably, certainly most crucially and disastrously, he disbanded the Iraqi army, secret police, and intelligence services, which threw 500,000 armed men into the street with no severance pay and no notice. And they they created the insurgency.
Okay, let's go through those a bit step by step. And I let me just share something with you, Charles. This is the first time we've spoken, and with the audience. I watched this film last night, and it's about 100 minutes, a little over an hour and a half. And what happened to me watching it was, I mean, I knew most of this, you know, the same way you knew going in a lot of this. But seeing it pile on one after another, it just made me so angry and so sad. It's really a powerful film. And for those of you in the audience who think you know this and you've seen this and you've been there and you've done that, the achievement of the film, I think, is how much you compress into that hour and a half and how powerful a statement it is. And let's hope that many, many more people see it and that people, for instance, who either are not actively involved in trying to end this war or end the reign of those who started it. Let's talk first about planning. You say there was very little planning, and the planning didn't really start until 2 months before the invasion. And yet the other point you make is there were volumes produced by the State Department.
Yes, I should be more careful. There actually had been a fair amount of planning and analysis conducted both inside the government and by others, the Army War College, the RAND Corporation, and the largest project inside the State Department, the Future of Iraq Project, which involved hundreds of people over 18 months.
And when you, by the way, when you see that on the film, you show the volumes and there's like, you know, a title of how to handle this issue, how to handle this issue. And it basically goes economic development, security. I mean, they really had done, who knows how good it was, but they had done a very thorough job.
A lot of work, yes. It certainly wasn't complete or perfect, but a lot of work had been done. By a lot of very competent, experienced people. And it was all discarded by the Pentagon. And in fact, Donald Rumsfeld explicitly ordered the first supervisor of the occupation, Jay Garner, to not hire people who had been involved in the Future of Iraq project because he regarded the State Department as, Rumsfeld regarded the State Department as politically unreliable and its people as politically unreliable. And the planning that Rumsfeld actually used did not start until after January 20th, when a presidential order gave Rumsfeld and the Pentagon complete control of post-war policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, just as an observation, to worry about the political reliability of folks once you've invaded and they're cleaning up, you know, they're sort of following it. I mean, what damage could they do to your political? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like if they could have stopped you from invading, that would be one thing. But once they're just helping you handle a situation you've created, it's quite astounding. So they purposely eliminate not only the planning and what you just told me is new, but anyone who was involved in the planning. And then they had 2 months to plan. And let's guess that those 2 months were not done by people with a great deal of experience in the Middle East, experience in Iraq, etc.
Some had experience, some didn't. I would say that General Garner, Jay Garner, did the best he could under the circumstances. A few experienced State Department kind of snuck in, among them Barbara Bodine, who Richard Armitage was able to place in charge of Baghdad and central Iraq. and a few others, but the level of expertise was certainly not what it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And these people, you know, they were given a suite of offices that didn't have telephones and computers. And when Barbara Bodine arrived 3 weeks before the war, she didn't have a secretary. And so people spent time trying to find office supplies when they were trying to plan the occupation of a country.
Mm-hmm. And then you say looting as the next major turning point. And it seems to me that was what set things in motion in the direction they ultimately have taken. Could you get any sense? In other words, what I noticed, by the way, is these cards come up on screen during the film and say, Bremer declined to be interviewed, Cheney declined to be interviewed, Rice declined to be interviewed. You could not get a word from the people who really were in charge of this, but could you get from anyone a sense of why they allowed the looting?
The sense I have, the best I can do, is it seems as if Rumsfeld and the small group of people who were responsible for these policies, but especially in this case Rumsfeld, felt that, first of all, it wasn't necessary to do anything about it, that it didn't have all that fundamental an effect. And secondly, and I think even more importantly, that they didn't want the obligations that came with declaring martial law, and they didn't view it as their role or their business to be running Iraq or helping Iraq. They thought that it was sufficient to depose Saddam and install a government friendly to the United States, made up of Iraqi exiles led by Ahmed Chalabi, and that once they did that, that everything would be fine and that it would be the Iraqis' problem and that, of course, they would see things the way we saw them, the way Rumsfeld saw them, and that would be that.
Yeah, except that as you show, and you show it, and it's very painful to watch, people saying everything in our heritage, which goes back 7,000 years, was in that building. It's all destroyed. Everything that all our literature, all our history that was in that building, it's completely destroyed. The sadness of one of the things which I think is, even though Iraq was a country created by Western powers, the people of the Tigris and Euphrates Basin had an identity, and it was stolen from them.
Yes, it was. It was destroyed. And yes, I think there's no question that an element of this was a remarkable cultural and social insensitivity.
Yeah. And that to juxtapose that with the thought that, okay, when Chalabi takes over, everything will be okay, even if this just happened, either with his, either because he thought it was a good idea or because the people who installed him thought it was a good idea. Just insane. But that's one of the most painful moments. Then Bremer relieves Garner. Now, you have, by the way, for people who are just tuning in, this film, No End in Sight, has interviews with Garner, interviews with Bodine, interviews with Armitage, and with Wilkerson, people who were integrally associated with this. Bremer comes in, relieves Garner, and, as you say, makes three colossal mistakes. What, again, Bremer refused to be interviewed. What is your best sense of why he did the things he did? And I'd say two of them go hand in hand, which is purging the government and purging the army. Both of them somehow a debathification and, a remove all shreds of Saddam. It seems that what you've just said is the interim government was their plan, and then it stopped. Any thought why?
Yes, there are a number of reasons, but they're all related to the fact that fairly soon after the war ended and the occupation began, it became clear that the political situation in Iraq was not going to permit the original plan, that Ahmed Chalabi was regarded with a lot of suspicion, that he did not have the kind of political base that he had claimed that he had, that he did not have the support even of exiled elites to the degree that he had said he did. And furthermore, Jay Garner didn't like him. And so and Jay Garner began the process of forming an interim government that involved a much larger number of people, and one in which Chalabi would probably be marginalized. And the Pentagon and the State Department both began to fear that the process would spiral out of control, out of their control especially, and that therefore it was necessary to impose American order on the situation.
Okay, that makes good. I mean, it makes sense. It doesn't work out, but I see it does make sense. It was the horse they were backing was not going to work, and something that Garner was trying to do, which it seems to me, it making his best efforts to actually create a broad based government was not something the United States, as led by the Pentagon, wanted. So then there comes the two crucial decisions of purging the government and closing down the army. And this time I won't ask you so much why, but just let listeners know, we've got a couple of more minutes, the effect of those two decisions.
Oh, they were devastating. First of all, they alienated a very large fraction of the population, just made people enormously angry and frustrated, but they also crippled the society. In the first place, a very high fraction of Iraq's economy was government run. So if you take away the senior administrators and technocrats, then you cripple not only the administration of the government, but you cripple the economy, including the oil industry, which produced 90% of its revenue, of the government's revenue. And the decision to disband the army was utterly disastrous. These men, in many cases, were desperately poor, frequently had not been paid by Saddam for months. And were supporting as best they could not only themselves but frequently extended families. And when 500,000 of them were told, you know, you don't exist anymore and you're not getting any severance pay, these people were frustrated beyond all conception, beyond all belief.
And as you point out, they were not merely frustrated; they were armed.
They were armed, and they knew how to get to enormous weapons caches that existed all over Iraq and which were left unguarded because, in the first place, the Americans didn't know where all of them were, and in the second place, they didn't have enough troops to take care of them.
Right. Now, let me just say again, this seems, again, like this kind of thing where, as bad as the plan, the Pentagon's plan was, it seems like it only would have worked had you been able to get a government up and running quickly and had you been able to insert the Iraqi army to supplement the low number of troops you had.
That's exactly right. And that, in fact, had been the original plan. And General Garner was working with Iraqi officers to recall the Iraqi army and had been able to obtain registration statements, in fact, from 137,000 soldiers when L. Paul Bremer made his decision to disband the army without consulting General Garner or any of the American forces in Iraq.
Right. Okay, we've got to bring this to a close. If that gives you a taste, listeners, of what you're going to see and what you're going to learn from No End in Sight, I highly recommend the film. The sense I was finally left with, Charles Ferguson, was that basically at a national level, at a huge level, what we saw was basically Katrina in Iraq. The same sort of cronyism, the same sort of incompetence, the same sort of lack of understanding, the same sort of lack of anticipation, all those things, but spelled out in a country of 30 million people.
Yes, unfortunately, I agree.
Okay. Film opens August 3rd in Los Angeles at a few theaters and around the country August 10th. I highly recommend No End in Sight. Charles Ferguson, thank you so much and keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.